Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Lobel, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 18th of July, these are our main stories. More than 30 people have been killed in an arson attack at an animation studio in Japan. The country's prime minister has described it as too appalling for words. Warnings to the UK about a no-deal Brexit from the government's budget watchdog and the EU's chief negotiator. And
this is really a call to the world that we now need to redouble our efforts in solidarity with people of Congo and stop this disease where it is now before it spreads any further.
What difference will the World Health Organization's declaration of the Ebola crisis in the DRC as a public health emergency make? Also in this podcast, 6 months after a deadly dam collapse in Brazil, new evidence has emerged suggesting the disaster could have been prevented. The Indian owner of a global restaurant chain who was convicted of murder has died at the age of 71. And
I asked him if he wouldn't mind singing for me, which he obliged. And as soon as he started to sing, his voice just gave me goosebumps.
How the talent of a potential opera star was recognised by a passenger in the back of his taxi cab. We begin in Japan, where, as we record this podcast, it's been confirmed that at least 33 people were killed and many injured after a man set fire to an animation studio in the city of Kyoto. The 41-year-old suspect is in custody. The fire broke out in a three-story building housing the Kyoto Animation Company, which produces popular shows and also graphic novels about teenage school life. I asked our correspondent in Japan, Rupert Wingfield Hayes, what was known about the fire and its causes.
What we've heard so far has come from the police, and they have a man in custody who they are questioning, although he's in hospital, and they also have heard from eyewitnesses, basically people who did manage to escape from the building and escape from the fire. And what they have described is that a man, we think in his 40s, went into the building in mid-morning this morning, and he was carrying a can of what they think was petrol or gasoline, and that he poured it onto the floor, on the ground floor of the building. And then as he set fire to it, according to eyewitnesses, he shouted, "Die, die," and he set fire to the petrol. Rapidly burst into flames and took the whole of the first floor of the building caught alight. He then ran out of the building and tried to escape from the scene. Apparently he was caught about 100 metres away from the building, but then the fire took hold very, very rapidly indeed and swept right up through the building. And it's really the people on the second and the third floor of the building who appear to have been trapped, unable to get out, and they are most of the victims, most of the fatalities are there.
There have been reports that there's been a potential motive uttered by the culprit, and that was about a grudge that he potentially had with this animation studio.
Yeah, I mean, this is unconfirmed reports so far, and I think we'll have to wait for the police to interrogate him and to, you know, come out with a statement to see what they have come up with as evidence. It's very hard to explain, but yeah, some sort of grudge could well be involved.
Rupert, this is clearly a shocking incident, especially for Japan, where these attacks are rare. What has been the reaction so far across the country from politicians to fans of the studio?
Just in the last hour or so, we've heard from the Japanese Prime Minister, who's come out and expressed his shock and sympathy. But that's come after, you know, the whole day on social media. There has been a huge outpouring of sympathy, concern, support from people here in Japan. But I have to say, it has not been limited to Japan. I've seen on social media fans of anime, of manga from every corner of the globe expressing their shock, their anger and their sympathy for the victims of this, what appears to be a terrible crime.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes speaking to me from Japan. It's looking more and more likely that Britain could leave the European Union without a deal. Both contenders to be the next British Prime Minister have said they're willing to walk away if they can't renegotiate a better agreement, but the consequences could be very serious. The UK's official economic watchdog today warned that the country could fall into recession, and in an interview for a forthcoming BBC documentary recorded a few weeks ago, the EU's chief Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier was equally pessimistic.
A no-deal Brexit will not be the choice of the EU. So that means that if there is, unfortunately, no deal, it will be the choice of the UK. And leaving the EU means so many consequences: human, social, legal, technical, financial, economic. That is why this document is the only way to leave the EU in an orderly manner.
And if we just left, if we just tore up the membership guard?
The UK will have to face the consequences.
I heard more from our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
What he revealed and some other senior EU officials is a pretty dim view in Brussels of how the UK has handled itself. They basically are utterly amazed that the UK seems to have absolutely no plan for Brexit. I think they're fairly horrified at what they would see as British politicians' refusal then and still now to level with the British people about just how difficult leaving the EU would be. And of course, that insistence that, look, we don't want a no-deal Brexit. It's going to be bad for us, but it's going to be worse for you, and it'll be your fault.
Rob, as this very serious soap opera continues, has there been any reaction from the two Tory leadership hopefuls or their camps?
Yes, there has, and it suggests that Britain and the European Union are on a collision course. I mean, one really has to pinch oneself when one says that, because both Mr. Johnson and both Mr. Hunt have said, look, it's the EU that needs to renegotiate its deal. The EU has said that it won't, and so that does leave you with the kind of conclusion that they're headed for a serious breakdown in relations.
And now we have this forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility, and it doesn't look particularly good. The British Chancellor says it shows how important a deal is secured.
Yes, I mean, what this independent OBR is saying is that, look, let's just take a relatively benign scenario, which is that a no deal would lead to a 2% drop in the size of the UK economy. Even that would have a massive effect on public finances. In other words, government revenues would go down, and therefore there would be a massive black hole in its ability to spend. You can guess exactly what's happened in reaction to these figures. Those on the Brexit side of the argument are going, oh, it's all more of your doom, whereas those on the Remain side have been saying, look, this just shows you the extraordinary financial economic challenge that Brexit presents.
And yet the tone of the debate has changed, hasn't it, since the beginning of the Tory leadership contest? No deal looking more likely now?
Absolutely, unless either the leadership candidates are lying about that's what they want to do, or that the EU does renegotiate, or finally that Conservative MPs who think no deal is crazy just bring down the entire show.
Rob Watson, our political correspondent. The Red Cross says the drought that's hit North Korea means that this year's harvest will be half of what had been estimated. The organisation has worked in North Korea for 25 years. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
A Red Cross assessment of North Korea's drought-stricken areas found that the harvest will be less than half what would be expected under normal weather conditions. Millions of people in North Korea are already chronically undernourished. Now, the Red Cross says, levels of malnutrition and of waterborne diseases are rising. It is appealing for almost $500,000 for fertilizers and water pumps in a bid to safeguard what remains of the harvest and protect communities who cannot cope with any further reduction in food supplies.
Imogen Folks. As we heard in the last edition of Global News, the World Health Organization has declared the Ebola outbreak in eastern Congo to be an international public health emergency. This is the WHO's highest level of alarm and has only been used four times previously, including during the Ebola epidemic in West Africa from 2014 to 2016. So how much practical difference is this declaration likely to make? Dan Damon put that question to Dr. Michael Ryan, the organization's Executive Director for Emergency Preparedness and Response.
I think it's a call to action at many levels. The committee and the Directorate General have issued recommendations and advice both to the government of Congo, to the surrounding countries and to the world at large, focusing in on improved cooperation, improved investment in community engagement, cross-border screening, intensification of surveillance and improved security operations on the ground to provide the enabling environment for public health operations, but at the same time cautioning countries that they should not put in place restrictive measures like closing borders, which would be counterproductive to the response.
And what about the laboratories? Let's talk about those, because in the 2014 outbreak in West Africa, it was when the international concern emergency was declared, that the number of laboratories and so on, the scientific effort was stepped up. Is that what will happen now?
Well, there is a lot on the ground. We currently have 7 laboratories in the field. We have more than 14 Ebola treatment units and transit centres on the ground. Tremendous amount has been invested by the government of Congo, by international partners in the response. The need now is to further intensify those efforts. This is not like 2014. There has been a massive effort on the ground, but that massive effort has been in the context of an extremely volatile and dangerous setting with huge levels of population mobility. And while we've seen significant improvements in the response, the extension of disease to Goma, the reinfection of Beni, have caused the emergency committee concern. And this is really a call to the world that we now need to redouble our efforts in solidarity with people of Congo and stop this disease where it is now before it spreads any further.
Dr. Michael Ryan of the World Health Organization speaking to Dan Damon. 6 months after a dam collapsed at a mine in Brazil, triggering a mudslide that killed nearly 300 people, a state prosecutor has told the BBC that the German company which certified the structure as safe is failing to cooperate with their inquiries. Investigators believe the company signed off the structure in Brumadinho even though they knew it was at risk of collapse. Our Berlin correspondent Jenny Hill reports.
Sinto a maior saudade de alguém que foi embora.
Through the red dust and lush trees of a mining community, a song for the dead. Aramaya wrote it for his sister. She and nearly 300 others were killed when the dam collapsed. She was downstream, serving lunch in the busy mine canteen. Nowhere to run, as a raging torrent of toxic sludge engulfed everything, everyone, in its path.
Destruidor, a gente se sente destruído. E juntando os cacos aqui e ali, juntando os...
We are devastated. We feel destroyed. We are trying to rebuild the community and trying to understand what really happened.
O que aconteceu?
Six months on, huge diggers toil up and down the ruined valley. Firefighters keep watch as mechanical teeth bite into the ground. Even now, they're finding bodies here.
With every hour that passes, the traces of this disaster disappear into a new landscape. But at the same time, fresh evidence continues to emerge. What happened here could and should have been prevented.
Far away, in Sao Paulo, rain lashes the metal bars of a gated grey building. This was the Brazilian headquarters of the German company which inspected the dam.
This was Tubsud's chance to gain a foothold in Brazil's lucrative mining industry. It's ended in disaster. The company has now left the sector. In fact, it's had to by law. But it leaves behind hundreds of ruined lives and a multitude of unanswered questions.
We now know two other firms refused to certify the dam as safe, but Tüv-Süd, a household name in Germany with a reputation for quality, signed it off, even though investigators believe staff knew the structure was at risk of collapse.
Nós percebemos que a posição da Tüv-Süd é mais de silêncio.
What we see now is that Tüv-Süd as a corporation is choosing to stay silent.
William Garcia is the state prosecutor responsible for criminal charges.
I have no doubt that a more collaborative attitude might bring new light to the case and also clarify what happened behind closed doors.
Meu Deus, tenha piedade, nos dê força e confiança.
Internal emails and documents seized by investigators offer some clues. They reveal that Tüv-Süd knew for about a year that the dam was liquefying and at risk of collapse. And they suggest that Tüv-Süd had access to data from the dam right up to the disaster. We now know, too, that Tüv-Süd changed the way the dam was certified, enabling inspectors to sign it off despite its weakness. But what we don't know is why. We travelled to the capital, Brasilia. but found few answers among the strange, stark architecture of this purpose-built city. The Brazilian parliament is investigating too. But Congresswoman Aria Carolina told us Tufsud isn't cooperating with their inquiries either.
Eu entendo que num processo criminal seja natural que...
In a criminal process, it's natural the accused don't want to explain everything. But this is a disaster of great magnitude with a shockingly high number of victims. This should involve our international relations with Germany, because Tufsud's headquarters are based there.
Sem precedentes no nosso país, então...
Back in Germany, we'd like to ask Tufsud whether they came under pressure from the mine owner Vale, and how far up the Tufsud management chain did decisions go?
We've come to Tufsud's Munich headquarters. Now, they don't want to talk to us. They've given us a statement saying that they're working intensely towards establishing what happened. This company, famous for its high standards at home, faces big questions now about its accountability overseas.
The German government have told us that, despite calls from some in Brazil, they have no responsibility in this case. For a short time, disaster drew the eyes of the world to Brazil's mining region. But those who survived fear it won't look back, leaving their questions unanswered and their dead forgotten.
Jenny Hill with that report. Now, here on Global News, we're marking the 50th anniversary of the moon landings in 1969. We've got scientists and experts, and we want to hear your recollections too. Were you excited? Were you inspired? Did it change what you wanted to do with your life? Do email us your story or record a voice message of up to a minute and send them to us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And still to come in this edition...
Social media is under scrutiny for being something that affects people's sense of well-being and self-esteem, and perhaps this kind of popularity contest isn't such a good thing.
We find out why Instagram has started hiding the number of likes on posts in several countries. The hugely successful Indian restaurant owner P. Rajagopal, better known as the Dosa King, has died in hospital a week after surrendering himself to serve a life sentence. He's been found guilty of ordering the murder of an employee. Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Itirajan, told me more about the man and why he'd been sentenced.
In March this year, the Supreme Court turned down his appeal to commute his lifetime given for the murder of one of his employees. At that time, his family argued that he was unwell, so he needed some time to get his treatment, and they asked for time till July. And so the court said he has to come and surrender in July, but he didn't come on the 7th of this month. But later, 2 days later, he was brought in an ambulance to a court in the southern city of Chennai. At that time, his family said he was in a very critical condition. Then he was taken to hospital straight from the court. And now his family say that, you know, he died of a heart attack. And the background is more interesting to the whole case because he was a very typical example of rags to riches story. We saw him in the mid-80s having a couple of restaurants in the city of Chennai. Now it became a big empire with hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue. But then his death has also brought a lot of debate about, you know, about the morality and the values in the business community in Chennai.
Indeed, because the murder that he was convicted of came after he said he took action after visiting an astrologer.
People in India, particularly those from the south, they strongly believe in astrology. If your child is born to give a name, they will consult an astrologer. If they want to, you know, improve their business, they will consult an astrologer. So, according to the local reports, he spoke with an astrologer who said if he marries a particular woman, then his business empire will expand much faster. But unfortunately, that lady was married to one of his employees. So the charges against him at that time was, so he ordered the killing of the husband of the woman he wanted to marry. He wanted to take her as his third wife, which was against the law as well. But the case dragged on for a long time. So it also shows how those powerful, and if you are a rich man, but still if you commit a crime, you can come down quite fast.
And Barasan Itirajan. The US is still grappling with an opioid crisis, with hundreds of thousands of people thought to have died over the last few decades. But there is finally some good news. Drug overdose deaths in the US have fallen for the first time in 20 years. According to preliminary data by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there were 5.1% fewer fatalities in 2018 than the year before, and this was down to a decline in deaths linked to opioids. Shaima Khalil found out more from Dr. Andrew Kolodny, the co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management, based in Massachusetts.
Every year for the past 25 years, we've set a new record for death from drug overdose. And then the next year, we break that record. And so this is the first time in 25 years that overdose death didn't go up and they actually came down a little bit.
And when we talk about drug overdose, we're also talking about opioid.
Yes, we are mainly talking about deaths involving prescription opioids and heroin and a new very potent opioid that's become widely available called fentanyl.
Why are we seeing this reversal in pattern for the first time?
Well, we should also recognize that there's nothing to really celebrate here. Even though deaths have come down a little bit, we are still experiencing an enormous death toll involving opioids. But the reason that the epidemic may not be continuing to get worse is that it's possible we're starting to do some of the right things. Prescribing of opioids in the United States has started to trend in a more cautious direction. And it does seem that more Americans who are suffering from opioid addiction are beginning to access effective treatment.
The startling phenomenon that we've been reporting on, that you've been dealing with, is it down to, as you say, the aggressive prescription of these drugs, or is there also a huge appetite there for them?
There's a huge appetite because millions of Americans have become addicted. This is an epidemic that began in the late 1990s as the medical community started to prescribe much more aggressively. Young opioid-addicted Americans have switched to heroin because a young person who becomes opioid-addicted, it's hard for them to continue getting pills from doctors. Older Americans are able to get pills pretty easily from doctors. And up until a couple of years ago, we were seeing more of the deaths in older Americans who were getting pills more easily from doctors.
What more needs to be done so you can see a consistent decrease in the numbers?
We have to prevent more Americans from becoming opioid addicted. In other words, reduce the incidence of this condition. That will happen through more cautious prescribing. And the other thing we have to do is see that the millions of Americans who are opioid addicted can much more easily access effective treatment for their addiction. The treatment for opioid addiction has to be easier to get than a bag of heroin.
Where does this start? Does it start with the pharmaceutical companies? Does it start with the doctors who prescribe these opioids quite easily? Or does it start with the people themselves?
The reason we started to prescribe so aggressively is that in many ways, the medical community was responding to a brilliant, multifaceted marketing campaign disguised as education. It was a campaign funded initially by Purdue Pharma, which in the UK goes by Mundi Pharma, as well as other opioid manufacturers. They sponsored a campaign that misinformed the medical community. As we started to respond to this campaign and the prescribing went up, it led to a public health catastrophe.
Dr. Andrew Kolodny of the Heller School for Social Policy and Management, speaking to Shaima Khalil. The photo-sharing social media company Instagram is starting a trial today which will hide the number of likes a post receives in several countries, including Australia and Japan. It comes amid concern that social media platforms can contribute to low self-esteem and feelings of inadequacy in young people. Instagram had launched a similar trial in Canada in May. Our technology reporter Zoe Kleinman told Dan Damon more about this experiment and why it's being carried out.
So this is a continued experiment that Instagram's been carrying out since April in Canada, where it decided to hide the likes attached to material that people were posting. Instagram says we want your followers to focus on the photos and videos you share and not on how many likes they get. They sort of don't want it to be seen as a popularity contest, I suppose. And we are looking, obviously, at a time in which social media is under scrutiny for being something that affects people's sense of well-being and self-esteem. And perhaps this kind of popularity contest isn't such a good thing.
It's a bit like Facebook and how many friends you've got, as I kept telling my children. They're not real friends, okay? But how does Instagram think that this might be negative, the number of likes and people chasing likes?
I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because obviously very popular celebrities will get, you know, thousands and thousands of likes on Instagram. And I suppose perhaps if you are sensitive about that, you could look at it and that could make you feel quite inferior when your own picture's only got, you know, maybe half a dozen. It's also worth bearing in mind, though, that this is actually quite a useful business tool for people who make money out of promotion on social media. You know, companies are more likely to approach them if it can see that they're getting a lot of traffic and getting a lot of engagement from the people that follow them. So they may well feel that actually this is a useful tool that they don't want to get rid of. It's not going completely, by the way. You will still be able to see how many people have liked your content, but other people won't. So if I were to look at one of your photos, I would see that I'd liked it, or I would see if somebody else I knew had liked it, and it would just say "and others." There wouldn't be a number attached.
This is about influencers, I guess. I suppose the influencers could publish their own numbers if they get lots of likes, could they?
Absolutely. There's nothing to stop them. And Instagram is certainly saying it's not going to hide them. I mean, the like button is sort of controversial. The man who invented the like button on Facebook has since come out and said he wishes he hadn't, because it's had such negative connotations and it's caused people distress and upset. And also, of course, you know, it's one of the mechanisms that these platforms use to keep you coming back. They want you to come back and see how your post is doing. And while you're there, of course, to share more data and engage with more advertising and make these giants a lot more money.
That was Zoe Kleinman, our technology reporter, speaking to Dan Damon. Menzi Ngoma is quite possibly South Africa's most famous Uber driver after a video of him singing opera to a customer went viral on Facebook, and he hopes the exposure will help him achieve his dream of becoming a professional opera singer, as Muhammad Ali reports.
When she went on a business trip to Durban, Kim Davey could hardly have imagined that her Uber driver, Menzi Ngoma, would be serenading her.
While chatting to Menzi, I discovered that he's a self-taught opera singer, and due to the lack of opportunity in South Africa, he drives Uber to support his family. I asked him if he wouldn't mind singing for me, which he obliged, and as soon as he started to sing, his voice just gave me goosebumps. I couldn't believe that a man with such talent was unable to use his talent.
Davey recorded a video of the 27-year-old Ngoma singing while he was driving, and the video, which was posted on Facebook, has since received more than 670,000 views.
I kept on saying to him, there must be someone who can help you. When I said goodbye to Menzi, I told him that he needs to follow his dreams and to put positive energy into the universe, and that something would come. Little did I know that I was going to be the person that was going to help him on his journey.
Ngoma says his singing is a God-given talent, but he has taken a particular liking to opera because of the challenges it poses.
The reason why I chose opera, there's a lot in the singing. Okay, I am a natural singer, but in other genres like gospel, jazz, all those type. But in opera, I found myself investing a lot of time trying to learn most of the things that you need to approach when you're an opera singer.
Since the video was posted in early June, Ngoma's life has changed dramatically. He's currently working on recording a single, has been invited to perform at the second annual South African Authors Awards in Johannesburg at the end of July, and he's cracked an invitation to compete in the Voices of South Africa International Opera Singing Competition to be held in Cape Town in mid-July. And he's already had a successful audition with Cape Town Opera.
Muhammad Ali reporting on Menzi Ngoma's exciting journey there. And before we reach the end of ours, here's some news about another BBC World Service podcast, which I think you'll enjoy.
I like that. I don't think I like that.
This
is the sound of crowd science.
Those very alarming sounds around. It's quite normal.
This is what women want. They want a man that can eat a stick.
I have a brilliant trowel.
That's tiny.
What you should see now is a cloud.
No way.
Each week, the Crowd Science podcast answers your questions about life, Earth, and the universe.
Are there foreseeable limits to knowledge?
It's an excellent question. Actually, it's a very deep question.
With the help of scientists around the world who are trying to find new answers themselves.
We think that people have a little more control over their brainwaves than they think they do.
That's Crowd Science from the BBC World Service.
We smash things together and we'll see what happens.
Just search for Crowd Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You've got brain freeze.
And that really is the end of the road for us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you have a comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Mark Lobel, and until next time, goodbye.